Oh, 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 O'Reilly.
You need parts? O'Reilly Auto Parts has parts. Need them fast? We've got fast. No matter what you need, we have thousands of professional parts people doing their part to make sure you have it. Product availability. Just one part that makes O'Reilly stand apart. The professional parts people.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Hey, everybody knows Weber Grills. I've been using Weber Grills my whole life, and check it out. They got a pellet grill, the Weber Searwood Pellet Grill. Now, with a pellet grill, you can smoke, roast, and sear on the same grill. You can go from low and slow, okay, on smoke boost mode, or crank this thing all the way to a heat sear at 600 degrees. It's got a full great sear zone, so you can put more food on the flame. Get fired up for your new Weber Searwood Pellet Grill. There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store, or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today.
Hey, everybody. Welcome. Episode number 8 of The Hunting Collective. I'm Ben O'Brien. Today, we are joined by pure nomad, Sam Soholt. Sam's somebody I met 5 or 6 years ago, and as a young photographer in the hunting industry, and somebody that I became fast friends with, and somebody who not only did I respect who he was and what he did, but I respected his creative vision and his work and all the things he did with a camera, with a rifle, with a bow, whatever. And Sam's also somebody who lives a life that a lot of people could respect. He lives as a nomad, kind of doesn't have an address. It's hard to pin him down. I know he used to live in Montana and sometimes in South Dakota, but he kind of always was everywhere and doing things, living life the way all of us would want to, just with a ton of freedom. And most recently, Sam has built a bus. He didn't build a bus. He bought a bus and then turned it into a camp, a mobile hunting camp, and took it around and used that bus to highlight public lands. And he's also has a company called Public Land Tees that he started. That money goes back into backcountry hunters and anglers for public lands from each purchase. So all these things put together make Sam a force in the hunting world and somebody I call a friend, and I'm happy to do so. So hopefully episode number 8 will be a good one for you. Please enjoy Sam Soholt. Sam, what's up, man?
Yeah.
What's going on?
Not much. I'm actually just sitting in my pickup at the moment. Figured that would be the quietest place where I could record this with you.
We've done a few. This will be our second where at least one of the participants, if not both, were in a pickup. And I find that to be okay. I have no problem with that.
Yeah. Yeah, it works.
As long as you're not driving.
Yeah, you and Callahan did it in the pickup in the show, didn't you?
Yeah, which is a bit of a Russian nesting doll of weirdness. Yes, we did. So you're not driving the truck, though. It's stationary.
I'm not driving. No, I'm not driving. I'm parked, but I thought it seemed fitting. I'm a fairly, you know, I travel a fair bit, so.
That's good.
Figured I might as well do it in my home.
Good.
Well, not, you know what I mean. Yeah.
I feel like the first thing to talk about is that it's turkey season. Because that's the only thing to think about right now. If anybody else is is a hunter and they're thinking about anything but turkeys, they're foolish. And I've had
turkeys and snow geese.
Yeah,
snow geese, you know, like
whatever.
Yeah,
whatever.
Yeah.
Snow geese, whatever. Let's get February. You can hunt snow geese.
Let's that's
back
right.
Back off.
That's right. Yeah.
You got some turkey plans coming up?
I do. Yeah, I'm gonna do a little turkey tour in the bus. Going to go chase some in Nebraska first before I go out to Boise for the BHA rendezvous. And then, depending on timing, probably chased some in my home state in South Dakota, and then you never know. Like with turkeys, it's kind of nice. You don't have to plan like a 10-day trip.
Yeah.
You know, somebody can call you and be like, "Hey, I've got turkeys." And I'll be like, "All right, I'll be there in the morning." And you go and shoot a turkey.
You're right about that.
I know it's not always the case for turkey hunting, but a lot of times you know, it's not like chasing mule deer or elk where you gotta have plenty of days to make sure you get it done.
We were talking about this the other day. Do you feel like there's a way to do a public land grand slam in the States?
There's gotta be.
Let's make that
right?
a thing. I mean, yeah, there's gotta be. Let's make that a thing. Because I don't know that anybody's ever said or did that. I just shot an Osceola in Florida. I don't know if there's
Were you on private?
Yeah. But I was looking around on the maps, on the Onyx maps, trying to figure out if there was public where you could turkey hunt. Because I feel like that's the only missing piece. I mean, I know you can hunt Easterns, Rios, and Merriam's on public ground. I know
no
that.
No problem. Yeah.
So
yeah.
If we could find the secret public ground spot for Osceolas, we're in.
I feel like between you and I, though, like we know enough people in Florida where we could make that happen.
Yeah, we just can't tell anybody if we find like the golden spot for Osceolas.
No, we can't. It'd have to be like, I don't know how we'd pull that off. We'd have to do it very publicly, but very secretive at the same time.
Yeah, we would just probably make up names. We wouldn't say what's really going on.
That's right. Yeah.
Because I can't imagine there's somebody from Florida can write in and tell us all about the public land turkey hunt.
Yeah.
But I can't imagine there's a whole lot of that going on.
Yeah, I wouldn't imagine so. But it seems like a good goal that we need to figure out how to pull off in the next couple of years.
That's true. Tell everybody why you think turkey hunting is the best type of hunting there is. Because that's, I mean, obviously, that's the reality.
Well, I don't know if it's... Okay, I'll just start. Turkey hunting is amazing. First of all, it's springtime. Like everything, you know, like just spring in general is great. It's kind of like the transition out of the deep freeze and, you know, if you live in the northern part of the U.S. And everything's growing back and everything's turning green. Everything smells good. And then you go out and you chase these like 12 to 20 pound dinosaurs that basically yell at you and try to attack you, and then you shoot them in self-defense most of the time. It took me a long time to get into turkey hunting. I never thought I would like it. I didn't like watching movies. I didn't like watching turkey hunting shows. I always thought it was just super boring, but I went and did it one time and I was like, I get it now. This is pretty cool.
Yeah. That's like almost saying like, tell me why Donald Trump is the greatest president or the best president? Choose one.
Yeah, you really phrase that in a tough way.
Because I feel like turkey hunting, Rogan talked shit on turkey hunting when he went with Ranella. And I feel like there's other people around that are popular that talk shit on turkey hunting. So I just feel like I need to be a voice for the greatness of the
wild turkey. Did they kill any turkeys?
I feel like, I don't know if Rogan killed a turkey or not. Probably not.
Well, that's probably why he's talking shit on it.
I know, but if he did, I don't know, I'll get him eventually. But I just feel like turkey hunting is just underrated. It's seen as like a redneck pursuit, which maybe it is. I'm a redneck, but
even if it is, it's worth it. Yeah, totally worth
favorite.
It.
You're talking to a giant raptor. Well, giant relative terms.
Yeah. And so here's the question for you. And you've done a lot more turkey hunting than I have. And a lot of people say that they're, you know, an incredibly smart bird. In my personal opinion, I think that they are so dumb that they are hard to hunt. they fly down from the roost. They have no idea what they're doing that day. They're like a ping pong ball. They're just like, you know, it's like a puffed up Roomba going from they hit the tree line and then they turn and then they just keep they go and they hit that field edge and then they just turn and they just, you know, they're just strutting around out there.
Yeah. I mean, that could be. There's times when you're turkey hunting and it seems like the most simplest thing you could ever do. See, you go out there, you shut the car door and they start gobbling, they come running in, you shoot them. Like I've had things like that happen where you just ask, like last year, 2 years ago in Florida, the turkeys were tough all morning. They weren't really gobbling. We didn't get into much. And we were walking back to the truck on this paved road. And there was a little food plot just down over this little palmetto ridge. And we were talking full voices. And I think this turkey gobbled at our voices. It was the first time it gobbled. And then I just went down over the hill and hit the call one time, and it came running through this palmetto, and I shot it like 5 yards. So then you're thinking like, I got to tell you, this can't be the hardest thing when that's going on.
Yeah.
But I think that we hunt them in just like white-tail deer. If you were only hunting white-tail deer in November, you would think they're the dumbest, you know, pussy hungry things there ever was.
Yeah.
So I think we, and then, you know, they've habituated or they've cohabitated enough that we'll see them in our backyards. You see them in parks sometimes. And so anything you see in those environments, you think might not be that smart. But I've hunted swamp gobblers in Louisiana that you just thought there's no way you'll ever trick it into coming near you. I mean, there's just, it just feels like you'd never get it done. So I think yes and no.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's all situational.
Yeah. So I'm reading an article now from our boy Steve Hickoff. You ever met Steve Hickoff?
I don't think I have.
He's a turkey killing genius. So he has an article on Realtree.com called "How to Get Your Turkey Hunting Grand Slam on Public Land."
Oh, nice.
And he wrote it in January. So the first thing he says, good news. 3/4 of the Grand Slam on public land is easy. Bad news, the quarter not accounted for is Florida's Osceola subspecies. Tagging a public land Osceola is tough. And he goes on. He goes on to list how tough it actually is. Oh yeah.
Seems worth trying though.
See, but that's it. We just got to spend like a whole month in Florida scouting, sitting on the beach, drinking booze.
Yep.
That's what we got to do.
Yeah.
That's the only way.
That doesn't seem terrible.
Hopefully Steve Hickoff listens to this and can help us.
I'll get an air conditioner, put in the bus, and we can roll that down.
Oh, yeah.
Have that base camp. Yeah,
man. Yeah, you get a lot of ladies get on that bus. Like when the bus pulls up and they see inside, a lot of young ladies want to get in there.
Are you asking that question?
Yeah, it's a question.
No.
They don't.
No, that's not a thing. It you know, surprisingly enough, luckily I have a girlfriend who loves the bus, but it's not exactly I wouldn't call it a female magnet. Big green and white school bus is not exactly alluring to the opposite sex.
Yeah, I would say for any regular listeners, I'm feeling a little bit more free flowing with the verbiage today, just because I'm drinking beer and I'm
that's okay.
Sam and I are good friends; we're not just acquaintances, so. It's gonna go where it goes. You're just gonna have to listen to it.
We've been in a few camps together.
Yeah, a couple times. Been here and there.
Yeah.
So just since we already touched on the bus, for those who don't know, give us the bus rundown and don't be shy on the details.
Okay. So it's funny. I was thinking about this before we hopped on the phone, and I was trying to figure out like when the bus idea first originated. And I actually remember telling the first time you and I met was up in BC with Rogan, and I remember telling you guys that I was thinking about buying a bus, and that was, what was that, November of 2014?
Yeah, it's almost, be 4 years ago this fall.
Yeah. So, I remember, like, and I think it was kind of like that's like spring of 2014, the bus idea had like popped into my head, and I was actually, you know, my brother and I had talked about, you know, buying a school bus, and actually we had originally talked about doing like a 12 state turkey tour in a school bus. So this, you know, like what we talked about earlier kind of segues great, you know, nicely into this. But it took me a while to kind of wrap my head around actually purchasing one, and it was not this last fall, but the fall before. I was kind of coming off a hunting season, and I was just, you know, I had a good year and had traveled a bunch and shooting photos and hunting for myself. The bus idea just hadn't gone away. And at that point I was like, you know, I'm turning 30 this year. Like the amount of time in my life where I can do something like purchase a full size school bus and build it out into a camper is diminishing quickly. So I was like, well, I'll just do it. And if I hate it, well, then I know I hate it. But if I don't do it, I'm always going to regret not, you know, pulling the trigger and doing this crazy adventure. And it was right after I decided to find a bus and buy one. I actually called you to talk to you about an idea that I had with the bus project, and actually relating it all to public land transfer awareness and trying to get the word out there, you know, to as many people as possible about the possibility of losing our public lands. And you and I kind of spitballed back and forth on the phone, and like, you know, I got in touch with BHA and have been working with them, and have been working with a few other companies, you know, Outdoor Life and those types of, you know, people to get the word out there. But yeah, it all originated fall of 2016, and I bought a school bus from Colorado and turned it into my rolling hunting camp.
Yeah. And how, like, when you you bought a Bluebird, what year was your Bluebird school bus that you purchased?
Some of the specs on it now. So it was a 1993 Bluebird, full size. So full size, 65 passenger. And I bought it so it was listed for $5,500, and I was able to talk the guy down to $3,500. So for $3,500, I owned 37 feet long. So I own 37 feet of vehicle.
Dude, right now I'm on eBay Googling used school buses, and this is seeing what's out there.
Good. There's a lot. It's amazing.
Unbelievable.
I'm not the first person to buy a school bus and turn it into a camper.
No, you're not.
Not even close, but I am the first one to do it in the hunting industry and relate it all to public lands.
Yes. So
I'll take that as like a small credit.
Here's a guy that wants the $13,000 for a 24 passenger, like a short bus.
Well, what year is it?
2005. Yeah, it's a newer one.
Is it four-wheel drive?
I don't know, man. It doesn't look like something I'd take off.
It's not. It's probably just a year. Yeah.
Oh, dude, four-wheel drive short bus? Come on, man. Like, that's another.
I know.
You should tow that behind the bigger bus. to deploy in off-road situations.
Step. Yeah. I'm going to get a van, a four-wheel drive van, and build that out. Pull that behind my.
Anyway, continue. You purchased this bus.
Okay, yeah. Purchased the bus. I bought it in Colorado, and I actually parked it. My brother owns a hunting shop in Fort Collins, and he's got a big lot behind his place. And I bought it, and I parked it there for a while because, to be honest, I didn't really have any goal other than getting the bus, and then I was going to figure it out from there. So I bought it, and then I went to ATA at SHOT Show, and I talked to a bunch of companies about the project and what I was doing, and that's where the connection to Outdoor Life came from. But it was, at this point, it was still just, I owned a school bus and that was it. And, so, you know, in the time between, I bought it on New Year's Eve, and the time between then and, April, I was just drawing plans and, you know, thinking of ideas and, not ashamed to say that I did a lot of browsing on Pinterest. Because apparently everybody else with a school bus puts all of their stuff on Pinterest. So there's a lot of interior design ideas. And I just kind of tried to figure out what I wanted it to look like. And then I ripped all the seats out in February. March, I was traveling for work. And then in April, I drove the bus back to South Dakota. My parents said I could park it at their lake place and do the whole build there. And which worked great for me because I got to live at the lake and wake up and go work on the school bus. But I, it wasn't until the end of May that I finally painted the ceiling and actually got to work on the interior. So I painted the ceiling and then I put down the floor. And then I put up all of the framework on the walls so that I could put up all of the pine on the walls and bolt everything to the outside so that way it wouldn't shift around. But I took it from yellow school bus with no seats to mobile hunting camp in 9 weeks.
Yeah, so did you draw a blueprint and then went to Home Depot, or did you just kind of go? I mean, you had a layout, right, before you went and bought all the materials?
Yeah, I had a layout. So after I painted the ceiling, and then I went in there with just blue masking tape and kind of the measurements of everything I wanted to put in there. So like the queen bed is in the back. So I put masking tape on the floor where the queen bed was going to sit. And then I kind of just roughly like guess like how much space I would want between that bed and like the bunk beds, you know, and then I masked off the bunk beds where those were going to sit. And then, you know, I just worked my way from the back to the front. And so I've got a queen bed in the back. I've got two sets of bunk beds, in front of that. So I can sleep five or six in the bus. And then in front of the bunk beds, and the bunk beds all open up for tons of storage, which is nice. I can keep most of my gear in the bunks or underneath the queen bed. And then in front of that, I have on the, we'll say on the starboard side of the bus, I have like kitchen area. So I've got cabinets up top for all of my cooking stuff, or like all, you know, spices and oil and like anything I would need to cook a meal. And then I've got a kitchen countertop that I've made out of old barn wood, and then I epoxied it. And I built a cabinet that houses both my battery system and then storage for my stove and pots and pans and all that kind of stuff. And then on the same side, I've got a little desk where I do all of my photo editing, video editing. And then on the opposite side, in front of the bunks, I've got a little room that was intended to be a bathroom, and I bought a portable toilet for it, but I have yet to use it. It turned into a just kind of like a little storage closet, and hang a bunch of clothes in there and stuff. And most of the time I just use great Mother Nature for any outdoor facility needs. And then, then I've got a space for my propane fireplace in front of that, and then a couch. And yeah, that the inside is great for just like, if it's just me, it's a ton of room, and it's a great living space. And then anytime I've got more people, I custom built the framework, but then had the canvas sewed for it. I have a 10x20 enclosed awning that sits next to the bus. So all in total, I have a little over 400 square feet of space when I have camp set up.
Man.
Yeah.
That's, I don't know that how in the, if I'm, I have any ingenuity in my body, but probably not enough to pull that off in the time that you did. And that I'm hoping you saved all the Insta story material from those.
Oh yeah.
From those deals. Yeah. Cause that was badass.
I've got a lot of content, just saved on the computer and the phone.
Are they saved on Instagram? You know, now you can save Instagram stories to your feed or to your page. Can people go and look at that, the build out on your Instagram?
So not right now. I could actually go back. I could go back and add a bunch of stuff, but I'm during what I'm going to do is during this turkey tour, or like this turkey hunt I'm doing the next couple weeks, I'm going to completely set up camp, like everything. And then I'm going to do a full walkthrough tour kind of my entire design and what's in there. And then once I get that video out, I'm going to let it sit for a while, and then I'm going to try to do it like a live Instagram feed where I can, people that have watched the video can ask questions about any part of it that they want.
And so your general advice to folks would be that you need some ingenuity, a school bus, and a ton of time, and you can do it.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, I mean, luckily for me, unless I'm on a photo trip, I don't have, you know, there's not all that much going on in between trips. And so I was able to, you know, I'd wake up at whatever, 7 a.m. and make a pot of coffee and send a couple emails if I needed to. And then I'd walk outside of the bus and get all my table saw and skill saw and miter saw all set up and my air compressor for my nail gun and just work until it was dark.
Yeah.
So
that's a,
I don't even want to add up how many hours, like, two things, like how many hours I spent inside of it just building it, and then how many times I walked in and out of it, like, just, you know, go in, measure one thing, go out, cut a board, go back in. Like, it was just, I mean, 10,000 times in 2 months.
I think the more interesting part of it is how you have come to have that free time, right? Because there's a lot of people that are listening to this on their way to work or at work or in a cubicle.
Yep.
And they would love, and most people would love to have the freedom that you have, right?
Yeah.
Because just tell folks what your job is currently and kind of what that entails.
So I guess my title would just be professional photographer in the hunting industry. I don't know if that's, Yeah, I mean, yeah, I do a lot of things, but yeah, that's probably like as general as I can get. But yeah, I started. I mean, it took me a long time for sure to get where I'm at. But I jokingly tell people I retired out of college, basically. But my first job in the industry was I was a camera op and video producer for Midwest Whitetail. I was finishing up my master's of business at North Dakota State, but all I had was an online class left, and so I took an internship with Midwest Whitetail and moved to Elbia and spent roughly 6 months in Elbia and was either hunting or filming twice a day and producing videos. I was producing the Michigan and Minnesota like weekly web shows. And then I was filming for the main show for Midwest Whitetail, and really picked up a lot of my, you know, video education from all the guys that I was working with down there. And then that transition, I moved to Colorado after that, and I was helping manage, like I said before, my brother owns a backcountry hunting store, but I was helping manage that. It's called Gannett Ridge, and I was producing video content for that shop. And then I moved to Montana as a sales rep, actually. I took a job through the owner of a rep agency who sold to my brother, and moved to Montana. But shortly after that, I had an opportunity to move to Alaska and film a couple different national TV shows for the Weather Channel and the History Channel, Coast Guard Alaska, and then The Hunt for the History Channel. And I jumped on that and moved to Kodiak for about 5 months. So, and then from that, it's just, you know, from there, it's just been all networking stuff. So, you know, meet one person on one show, and then that led to the History Channel, and then that led to me meeting Chris Ellis, who you know pretty well.
Oh, yeah.
And, yeah, and Chris is a PR guy in the industry, and he hired me to do my first professional photo shoot for Remington. And then through all of those events, you know, it was actually a Remington event where I met Mike Scobie, who then forwarded you my portfolio and then got hired to go up to BC. So it's, I became a photographer. You know, I feel like I have a pretty good eye for photography, but I think I became successful in what I do because of just networking as much as possible and just meeting, you know, as many people as I could on every single trip.
Yeah, I think I'm sure that's a huge part of it. I mean, but there's some innate need not to sit at a desk that I think drives people to find.
Yeah.
I'm sure you found, like, what's the thing that's going to get me free or keep me free? And if it was networking, sure, that would have been it. Yeah, was it. Or if it's I need to be talented in these areas, that's what you need to do.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think forever, you know, growing up, I think I was never destined to be at a quote-unquote normal job. I always wanted to, you know, be in the outdoors. And a long time had a dream to be doing something in the hunting industry. And I think the further I went down the path that I'm on, the more I realized how much I didn't want to be like in a building every day. And, fortunately for me, I just, you know, was able to keep that going and work my ass off to where I am now. So, but I mean, after doing it for so long and, you know, and having the type of flexibility that I do, you know, I can hardly imagine, you know, trying to work for a company or work for whoever, you know, and where I clock in at whatever 7 a.m. and clock out at 5 or whatever it might be. That would be really tough for me, you know, or it might be really good for about 6 months, and then I would be cooped up and itching to go. So now it only takes me about 3 days before I'm ready to move on to the next adventure.
Yeah, I'm with you, man. Yeah. I am tortured by that balance.
Yep.
As they call work-life balance, but I just call it like life balance. You know, work is what you do that interrupts your life, for sure.
Well, I think, you know, as cliche as it sounds, I mean, we only get one shot at this whole thing. So, a long time ago, I decided, like, I don't want to waste not that, you know, working is wasting your life, but I just wanted to do as many things as I could possibly fit in. Like, I want to just be completely wore out at the end of my run.
Yeah.
And I knew that working a normal job for me personally was not going to get me there.
O'Reilly Auto Parts are in the business of keeping your car on the road. O'Reilly Auto Parts offer friendly, helpful service and the parts knowledge you need for all your maintenance and repairs. If you're confused about what part you need, like what wipers are going to be the best, what replacement headlights are going to be the best, go into O'Reilly and talk to the people that work there because they're great and they're super friendly and they'll get you squared away where you walk out knowing you got the right thing. They've got thousands of parts and accessories in stock, either in-store or online, so you never have to worry if you're in a jam. Do you need your windshield wipers replaced? You need a brake light fixed? You need some quick service? They'll help you find the right part or point you to the nearest local repair shop for help. The professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts are your one-stop shop for all things auto do-it-yourself, and you can find what you need in-store or online. Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts today or visit us at O'ReillyAuto.com/meateater. That's O'ReillyAuto.com/meateater. Pay attention here because this is a hell of a good service. It's called the Wellness Company. Picture this, okay? You wake up, you got a scratchy throat, you're all congested, you got a runny nose, you got a cough, whatever. And you weigh your options like you tough it out, get sick, take time off work, try to get a doctor's appointment sometime in the next few months, wait 2 hours at urgent care and sit in a room full of six sick folks, or you open your medical emergency kit. You match your symptoms to the doctor recommended prescription and you start on the right meds right away. These medical emergency kits, not a first aid kit, all right? It comes with doctor prescribed meds to treat over 39 medical issues. So, on hand, strong antibiotics for infections of all types. Plus, a doctor's easy guide so you know exactly what to take and when. No waiting to see the doctor, no waiting at the pharmacy. It's all in there. Every home should have at least one medical emergency kit. Order yours online in minutes. Your kit will be rushed to your door. Get 15% off at twc.health/meateater, but you got to use the promo code meateater. That's promo code meateater, okay, at twc.health/meateater. Hey, if you guys like to cook outdoors, and you ought to, you should check out the Weber Slate Rust Resistant Griddle. Now, this is a good innovation here, and it solves a real problem, okay? So this is a carbon steel cooktop that's safe for metal tools, like a griddle on your grill. It's pre-seasoned with food-safe oils and ready to cook on right out of the box. There's no use of coatings, okay? You can use metal tools to flip, press, and scrape without worry. It's the griddle that stays ready, not rusty. Now, everything, the problem with griddles, everything rusts. No one talks about how bad everything rusts. The reason they don't, because they couldn't fix it until now. Well, Weber's new rust-resistant technology, your Weber grill will last for years. When used, the carbon steel griddle hardens and bonds the surface, reducing the ability for moisture to collect and rust to form. With the new Weber Works Prep Cook and Store system, you can keep cooking and cleaning supplies handy, carry food and condiments from the kitchen to the griddle, and even convert the side table into a prep station. Get fired up for your new Weber Slate rust-resistant griddle.
Yeah, I mean, that's good. I mean, the good advice for people that are in that situation or who are realizing that their path maybe took them in a wrong direction, where your path, I think, took you in the right direction for you.
Yeah.
That, you know, you can always change that. I mean, there was no template for you. Like nobody laid out like, hey, Sam, if you go on this moose hunt with Ben and Joe Rogan and take some photos, next thing you know, you'll have a career. Hey, if you want to shoot some Remington photos of some guns at a media event, that next thing you know, you'll be hanging out with Joe Rogan. Like if you reverse the steps that led you to where you are, at each step you wouldn't believe the other. And that's how I am too.
No. Not a chance.
you wouldn't. When you were in that Remington shoot, somebody said, hey, the next thing you're going to do is take photos of Joe Rogan for a Peterson's Hunting cover in British Columbia on a moose hunt. You'd be like, shut up, dude. No way. You're high.
Yep. Never would have believed it.
Absolutely. Well, we should probably talk about that hunt, because you just posted.
A couple of days ago. It was the 3-year anniversary of when I saw it hit the shelf for the first time.
Yeah.
I was actually in Arizona, leaving a Remington new product seminar media event, and got into the airport and there it was sitting on the shelf.
So this was the whole backstory on this. We kind of touched on a lot of it, because I think it just is kind of the thread that pulls your and I's relationship, just because it was such a great, beyond just what it was, like the time spent together was so good that my position at the time, this would have been, you know, like I said, 2014. I was a managing editor at Peterson's Hunting Magazine, and we had done one issue the year prior that was, we called it the Meat Eater edition of Peterson's Hunting. And it was a giant piece of bloody meat. April, it would have been April 2013. A giant piece of bloody meat on the end of a knife. And it was widely acclaimed and widely criticized, that cover.
Yep. Which is a good thing.
Yeah, which...
That's what you're going for.
Yeah, which turns out is a good thing, right? You know, in that conversation, Steven Ranella was a big part of that article, and he said to me, hey, man, I asked him, who else is do you think is just hunting for the meat, or people that you know that are kind of new to hunting and are picking it up just for meat? And he said, Joe Rogan. And I said, the guy from Fear Factor? Are you sure? we're talking about the same guy? He's like, yeah, man, I took him hunting, you know, a few months ago, and it was first time hunting, but he just cares about the meat. That's all he wants to do. I was like, well, I better call that guy and get the lowdown from him. So I ended up calling him. We talked for a couple hours, and he got like a sidebar in that April 2013 feature article that included Ranella. Yep. But then when we were thinking about, like, what's the April 2014 Meat Eater, because we wanted it to be an annual thing, what's the April 2014 cover going to be? My first thought was, like, it's got to be Rogan, just for who he is. And through that time, I'd gotten to know him a little bit better. Yep. And so then we decided we were going to go moose hunting, because Joe said that's the most possible meat he could get is from a moose. And I agreed. We found an outfitter who was Mike Hawkridge, who's up in Quesnel, British Columbia. And then we were at the last minute, like, man, we obviously need a photographer. A bunch of people weren't able to do it. And Scobie came by. He's like, man, I met this young guy, this guy Sam, at this Remington writers event, and he's super talented, and he'll go with you, I promise, and he'll do a great job. And so I think, I don't know if I called you or emailed you, the next thing you know, you were signed up to come, right?
Yeah, I think I got an email, and then you and Scobie both called me, just we had like a little conference call, and it was basically like, hey, can you be in D.C. from November 2nd through the 9th? And I don't think you even finished the sentence. I was like, yep.
I'll be there.
Yep. Sounds good.
Perfect. Yeah. Most hunters, when you say come to British Columbia in November, they're like, yeah, I can do. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. I can do that.
Yep. Yep. I can make that happen.
Yeah. So then we went up there. The first time I met you, first time I met Joe in person, first time I met Mike Hawkridge in person. And next thing you know, we're rolling around in a beat up pickup truck, chasing glass and cut blocks for, moose and laughing our ass off. And that was one of the few times where you literally meet people for the first time, and the next thing you know, you're having the time of your life with them, whether you were hunting or not.
Yeah,
I don't think it would have mattered.
No, it wouldn't have. Yeah, that was a great trip. And there's I get to go on a lot of different trips, and the feeling, you know, like in the truck or in the camp, is not always just that easy. So that was pretty cool.
Yeah, so then we...
And it ended up being a hell of a successful trip.
Yeah.
It's not the middle of the rut, so we're not, you know, calling in bulls from half mile away or whatever, but it was, we just spent a lot of time going to, you know, different places and finding any moose we possibly could. And I think still one of my favorite memories on any hunt was when we spotted Joe's moose, and Mike was like, it's not very big. Rogan's like, I don't care. and then he shoots a moose, and then we, the next day we you know, after we got the meat all cleaned up and everything, we took that photo, and then the next day we go out, and you shoot a moose, and the next thing we know, his brother is just sprinting down the road.
Oh, yeah.
And I have a, you know, I still have that photo of him. the moose, like, you know, like just, like, in the background, and Joe's just running.
Yeah, just run. Well, and that was a whole, like, so I'm looking at the cover now. I got my years wrong. The first cover was April 14. The second cover was April 15. These things happen.
Yeah.
Yeah, these things happen different years, obviously.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, I remember, like, I look at the cover now. So if you look at the April-May 2015 cover of Peterson's Hunting, I'm sure you could just Google Joe Rogan, Peterson's Hunting. You'll see it.
Yeah.
It says, "Eat what you kill" down the left side. Joe Rogan celebrates the wild meat movement. It has a bunch of other blurbs and stuff around it. But it's just a picture of Joe holding a giant moose quarter for just, I mean, there really is no reason he'd be holding it like that other than to just show people this is it,
right,
bitches. Like, this is what, it's what we do. And I remember we shot a bunch, we had a bunch of ideas for how to shoot the cover, and we tried those and they just didn't quite work. And this, the cover of him holding the moose quarter was a kind of an afterthought. And we were standing in this weird, like, kind of dead field with not a whole lot going on.
Yeah, it was almost just like a little, you know, whatever, an acre of pasture land.
Yeah.
And he had enough, you know, there was enough of a rise where he was standing on the top of the rise, and I was able to get low enough to get, you know, a little bit more clear sky or gray sky in the background. And yeah, because I don't know how many different types of photos we shot. It was a lot, but I'm happy with the one that they ended up picking.
Yeah, I remember in with the art director, I sat and he picked that photo, and once I saw it in the cover, I thought, "Holy shit, that's going to be good."
when I saw it,
and the other thing I remember is that Joe was bitching the whole time because he didn't want to do it because he wanted to go hunt.
No,
he wanted me to get a moose.
Right, like he still had an uncut tag, and so he was just chomping at the bit, you know. And I mean, we didn't spend an overly long amount of time, you know. Like, it was a few hours that we were, you know, playing with different ideas and shooting stuff and sending it off or whatever. But the whole time he was just like really mad every time he had to, you know, pick something up or whatever. He was just, you know, basically just white knuckling it, wanting to be out there chasing animals and not dealing with what we were doing.
I think later he trusted us, though. Like, once he saw I think he was like, "Oh, okay, I get it." But yeah, so we shot this thing and jumped in the truck, and we're driving out to a cut block where he'd seen a bull in the days prior to that. And I'm driving on the road, and two big bulls run across, a big for that area, run across the road. So we park the truck, get out. I jump out. I'm shooting a Blazer R8 straight pull action rifle. So I jump out, get in the bar ditch, get up on the side. These moose run around this corner, and I shoot them. I just start wailing away. I mean, it's the last day or second to last day of the hunt, and we've hiked and we've classed, and like, we haven't seen a moose anywhere near the size of either one of these bulls. So I'm up in this little area above the bar ditch, and I shoot, hit the bull. He's stumbling around. And I go to reload, and he's dead at this point on his feet. And I go to reload, and Rogan has already started running down the road towards this bull who's stumbling back and falling around. By the time I get the gun back, reloaded and back to my shoulder, he's halfway to the animal, and it's just now falling over and dying. And what did he say, like, what did he say afterwards? I just wanted to be there when it died, or I wanted to see it die, or I can't remember.
Yeah, he's like, I don't know. Like, next thing I know, I'm just running. I'm halfway there.
He went full Forrest Gump on us, didn't he? He just started running.
Yeah.
No reason. So we have that photo. Of course, you have that photo. And And then we have that photo, and then we have the cover photo. But I think just that hunt, I mean, afterwards, we cut that bull up, took it back to camp, took care of it, and then we went to down in several bottles of, what was it, Spice Box rum?
Oh, Spice Box.
Oh, God, Spice Box rum.
Yeah.
I'm
hungover just thinking about it.
Yeah, no, I'm starting to gag a little bit just thinking about Spice Box rum. Now, the makers, if anybody here works at the Spice Box rum factory that's listening to this, it's a fine product. It's just you can't drink You can't drink 2 liters of it and expect to be all right.
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely delicious.
Yeah, it's a spicy rum.
You know, you can't sit there and tell stories about the hunt and keep, you know, drinking glass after glass for several hours.
Well, we ate. Joe was grilling up moose liver and moose heart.
Yep. Yep.
And we were over there taking shots and partying with our guide, Mike Hockridge, and having a fun party, and just kind of got out of hand a little bit, and we had a good time, though.
Yeah. And then during, like, while we were eating and cooking and drinking Spice Box, there was a UFC event going on, and Joe pulled it up and streamed it, and he was basically commentating for all of us sitting at the table.
And didn't a roadkill beaver show up at some point?
Yes. Yes, it did.
Yeah,
I completely forgot about that.
I have a photo of you and Hawkridge and a beaver. And I don't these are the things that happen in the haze of Spike's Box Rum. Like, this was kind of...
Yep.
And next thing you know, a beaver shows up. There's nothing you can do about it.
Yeah, Mike just came through the door with, like, a... I mean, that thing was giant.
Yeah, one of his buddies has killed a giant beaver, a roadkill beaver. Found a beaver on the side of the road, and they just brought it in.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they were cutting it up to eat it, and we took some pictures with it, which was totally respectful, I thought, of the animal and its life.
Yeah. You know, I think we were in Canada, though. You know, like, it's never failed. There's always some weird stuff that happens.
Yeah.
Canada's a lovely country. But there's always going to be something strange.
Yeah, I love.
There's no doubt.
Love you, Canada, but yeah, sometimes you're messed up.
Yep.
Nothing you can do. But yeah, I mean, I just think everybody has a hunt like that, I think, probably in their life, you know, that you didn't know what to expect, and then it was something where even now, when that image pops up, I don't really think about that cover and what people said about it later or any of the reaction to it. I just think about the time we spent in camp and what that kind of meant for me. And I also think that Joe, during that hunt, and you were there, and you were kind of in on the conversation, Joe was like, you should start a podcast, Ben. And I was like, I was like, listen, Rogan, I don't even know what that is. It's 2014. Nobody podcasts. Like, what am I going to talk about for hours on end on a podcast? And he said, you should do it, man. I'll help you out. And I was all fired up. I think I even called my dad and said, I'm doing a podcast. And then I just got back to the real world and let it go.
Well, I think what happened was we got back, and then it was not that long after that you accepted a job with what you're doing now.
Yeah, you're true.
And so so I mean, it just kind of all got put on the back burner just from moving on in other ways.
Yeah, that's true. Okay. Yeah, it was maybe say 3 or 4 months after that. And I met you at SHOT Show, and I was like, dude, I got to tell you, I'm taking a new gig at Yeti. And you were like, well, shit, man, I'm taking a gig at Yeti, too. I was like, oh,
yep.
That'll work.
Yep.
Sold.
We both got hired by Yeti.
We did.
Yep.
And here we are. But, yeah, I mean, that hunt, I think, changed a lot about the way I thought of things. I think it was the first time I realized that there could be an elevation in the conversation past our bubble. Because even with you, as young as we both were at the time and still are, you kind of get into the industry bubble and you have your conversation and you feel like that's what it's always going to be. And then you meet somebody like Joe Rogan and you elevate the conversation with a cover like that and the image like that. And next thing you know, you realize, man, we could talk to a lot more people. We could take this message and spread it a lot further than it's currently going. And so I think, I don't know about you, but for me, that was the first time I realized what it could be.
No, and I think in addition to that, like, I mean, if you're talking about, like, just eating the animals that you go out and shoot, you know, like, growing up, you know, we always ate whatever. We did a lot of bird hunting when I was younger, so we ate a lot of pheasant and turned a lot of ducks into jerky and ate deer when we shot deer. And, you know, it was always all, you know, really good and tasty or whatever, but it never seemed like something out of the ordinary, because that's just what you did, you know? I mean, and once you look beyond that, you know, like seeing it through the lens of that cover and like the controversy that it stirred up and the, you know, allowing people to talk more about, you know, basically knowing where your food comes from and controlling the consumption of your meat and that type of thing, it allows you to open your mind about what hunting means to society as a whole. And then to me, personally, it actually made me appreciate wild game meat way more than I ever had.
Yeah.
And what that, you know, like what that means to me in relation to everybody else.
Yeah, and I think that was probably the first time that I really, was able to drill down to how I wanted to go forward, you know, how I wanted to talk to people about hunting. Seeing Joe, you know, Joe shot, the bull he shot was a forked antlered, young moose. I mean, he's a young bull.
Yeah.
And he shot it off the, you know, shot it just in the bar ditch off the road, much like I did. And so, you know, if I were to fast forward 4 years and say, what's that, the hunting purity score of that hunt? I'd be like, oh man, when it came down to came down to the actual hunting, it wasn't all that great. It was a rough time of year. The weather was weird, but if you take that away and be like, we just got, each of us got 200 pounds of meat, more probably than that. And I remember Hawkers driving that meat down over the border into LA to deliver it to Rogan. And I remember how excited he was to shoot this fork antlered, you know, moose and what it meant to him to cut it up. And it was like, wow, okay. Here's somebody who's 45 years old, never hunted before, and doesn't give two shits whether it's a forked antler or it's a 70-inch moose. And I don't know if that was the first time I've been around somebody like that, but it was the first time I was impacted that seriously by that idea.
Yeah, no, I would definitely agree with that. I mean, because you and I both grew up in hunting families, and so when you're breaking down an animal, it's like, it's not this brand new experience. Really. I mean, like when you're a kid, it's a new experience, but your dad or your older brother, or your uncle or whoever takes you out hunting, like has done it however many times. And so, you know, they don't make like a big deal out of it, but to watch somebody who, you know, got to from start to finish, you know, shot the animal, skin the animal, cut it apart, like, you know, and Mike was kind of walking through it, like the different, you know, sections to start cutting out. I mean, it was really cool to be part of that whole experience.
Yeah. Yeah. And, it changes you a little bit. That changed me. I don't know. I wrote even this week when you posted that, hey, it's been whatever, 3-4 years since that happened. I was like, man, I look back at that now and I'm like, I'm glad it happened the way it did.
Yep.
Could have never guessed that would have been how it would have all went down, but it sure did. And I'm glad it did. That's for sure.
Oh. Yeah.
I wanted to,
go ahead. Oh, go ahead. On that trip, I was starting to get a little bit nervous because it was getting later in the week before we ended up knocking the first moose down. And, I'm glad it all panned out the way it ended up panning out.
Yeah, no, it did. And then
I
will, I've got that, the room I'm sitting in now here with the bar, I've got that cover hanging on the wall. So it's something that I personally think means a lot, and hopefully it meant a lot to the, you know, I certainly got a lot of compliments at the time, even more so later as time's gone on. But, I think it's seminal in the way that I see things.
O'Reilly Auto Parts are in the business of keeping your car on the road. O'Reilly Auto Parts offer friendly, helpful service and the parts knowledge you need for all your maintenance and repairs. If you're confused about what part you need, like what wipers are going to be the best, what replacement headlights are going to be the best, go into O'Reilly and talk to the people that work there because they're great and they're super friendly and they'll get you squared away where you walk out knowing you got the right thing. They've got thousands of parts and accessories in stock, either in-store or online, so you never have to worry if you're in a jam. Do you need your windshield wipers replaced? You need a brake light fixed? You need some quick service? They'll help you find the right part or point you to the nearest local repair shop for help. The professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts are your one-stop shop for all things auto do-it-yourself, and you can find what you need in-store or online. Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts today or visit us at O'ReillyAuto.com/meateater. That's O'ReillyAuto.com/meateater. Pay attention here, because this is a hell of a good service. It's called the Wellness Company. Picture this, okay? You wake up, you got a scratchy throat, you're all congested, you got a runny nose, you got a cough, whatever. And you weigh your options, like you tough it out, get sick, take time off work, try to get a doctor's appointment sometime in the next few months, wait 2 hours at urgent care and sit in a room full of six sick folks, or you open your medical emergency kit. You match your symptoms to the doctor recommended prescription, and you start on the right meds right away. These medical emergency kits, not a first aid kit, all right? It comes with doctor prescribed meds to treat over 39 medical issues. So, on hand, strong antibiotics for infections of all types. Plus, a doctor's easy guide so you know exactly what to take and when. No waiting to see the doctor, no waiting at the pharmacy. It's all in there. Every home should have at least one medical emergency kit. Order yours online in minutes. Your kit will be rushed to your door. Get 15% off at twc.health/meateater, but you got to use the promo code meateater. That's promo code meateater, okay, at twc.health/meateater. Hey, everybody knows Weber Grills. I've been using Weber Grills my whole life, and check it out. They got a pellet grill, the Weber Searwood Pellet Grill. Now, with a pellet grill, you can smoke, roast, and sear, what I like to do, on the same grill. You can go from low and slow, okay, on smoke boost mode, which gives you great smoke at 180 degrees, or crank this thing all the way to a heat sear at 600 degrees. It's got a full great sear zone, so you can put more food on the flame. This is my way of bold saying. If I was going to cook roast one way, that's how I like to do it, sear roast. Utilize the smoke boost setting to intensify that smoky flavor. Direct flame cooking creates searing, crisping, and browning. Food's going to look as good as it tastes. This grill gets hot in 15 minutes. Cleanup is easy. Cook confidently with intuitive digital controls at the grill and enjoy the sleek, easy-to-use surface. You can also add a heavy-duty rotisserie or rust-resistant griddle insert to up your game. Get fired up for your new Weber Searwood pellet grill.
The other thing I wrote down that I wanted to talk to you about, because I think maybe you'll have some similar experiences to me, or we'll be able to share some stuff, is when public lands has been a big part of what you've been doing recently, right? With the bus and just how you grew up and big part of who you are. What was the first time you realized what public lands were? Like what they meant to the country, what they mean to you as a hunter. What was the first time you feel like you really had true perspective on public lands?
You know, I mean, slightly embarrassingly, like I probably didn't think about it enough until there was a possibility of them losing them. You know, I mean, it was always something that was just there. And so I think it's definitely something that I took for granted. You know, I mean, growing up in South Dakota, there's definitely some public land, but it's nothing compared to the West. I think, you know, once I moved West, you know, and I'm a Montana resident now, I think it definitely opened my eyes to, you know, you look at the Atlas or the map or Onyx maps or whatever it might be. And, whereas back home it was, you know, you've got whatever, maybe a half section or a full section of public in different spots. Whereas, you know, in Montana, you've got however many millions of acres, and when you can park at one trailhead, and you can just like, all right, I don't need to look at the map anymore unless I need to know, figure out where I'm going. Like, I just know I'm going to be on public land. I think that was definitely an eye-opening experience. You know, the fact that you can not only walk to that ridge, but you can walk to the ridge after that and the ridge after that and the ridge after that.
Yeah.
And you just, you know, continue chasing animals as far as your legs will carry you. But to be perfectly honest, it wasn't until it was part of the platform to possibly transfer lands to the States, which for a lot of people out there that might not know is a cute way to package it up and sell it to the general public. But as we've seen through history, a lot of the states that are given you know, land, and it's managed by the states. A lot of times that ends up getting sold off. And so I think once I saw the possibility of, you know, stuff being transferred or stuff being sold, or, you know, like land swaps and different stuff, I think it really opened my eyes to the opportunity that I've had in my lifetime to, you know, spend and have experiences that have molded me into the person I am. To have something like that go away for future generations was, you know, kind of hit me pretty hard.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that was, it was my exact same experience, because I that was my guessing of what your answer would be. So I think a lot of people, I grew up on the East Coast in Maryland, and we hunted Green Ridge State Forest, like, was our backyard. And we never, my dad never said, "Hey, son, do you realize what we're doing right now? You realize what this land is? You realize what, who it belongs to and why it's important?" It was just never, much like everything growing up, it was just never a topic, because it was the thing that you did. And there was never any need to explain it, because it wasn't in peril. And there wasn't
right.
like, "Hey, you need to know this because you might lose it." It was, "This is ours. It will always be ours. And this experience will be in perpetuity." And then when you start to get a little bit older and you see that maybe that's not the case, you start to want to learn and defend the thing that you grew up with as a reality of your life, and just a something that was always there for you, something that you probably needed and didn't even know you needed at some level.
Yeah.
And so you learn a little bit more about public lands probably through osmosis, but also probably because it was important to you. Why does then you flip the switch to activism as you have?
Well, I don't know. I just, growing up, you know, I was a Ducks Unlimited member, and I was a Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation member, and, you know, different conservation organizations, but it was, you know, all of that, and there's nothing wrong with this, but all of that was more so about, like, you get the magazine and you go to the banquets and you hang out with other people that hunt and that kind of thing. But I never, you know, volunteered for a creek cleanup or a nesting site cleanup or a fence removal or, you know, whatever that was. And so I think there was probably a little bit of guilt there, where I have been growing up in a country where I can go out and hunt, and I was never doing anything to give back. And so I think, as the sportsman in me, like, I just looked at, you know, the voice, being a small voice that I have in the hunting industry, and I just thought, it felt like it was my duty as a sportsman to try to do what I can personally to protect that for future generations. And so it was, you know, once that switch flipped, it was 100% go time. And I was like, all right, I guess it's time to just talk about this and tell as many people and get involved and raise money and, you know, do my part to, you know, have this be something that is an opportunity for anybody, not just people who are hunting now, but someone who might want to get into it. Or, you know, if I have kids, my kids and their kids, and, you know, it's just, it'd be hard for me to live in a country where people can't grow up and have the same opportunity that I have right now.
For sure.
You know, it's good for the soul. I don't know what else there is to say about it. I think without those wild places, there's no release. And I think we start to change as a society.
Yeah. I mean, I think, I live in a country called Texas, and, it doesn't have the same freedoms as the West has. I mean, there's man, before this I lived in Illinois, and it's the same way. So it's not exclusive to Texas. I think our idea of public lands and the freedom to explore is decidedly a Western idea. And that's for a lot of reasons. One, but mostly because a lot of that land is wilderness, and a lot of that land can't be turned into a profit center. Unlike Texas or Illinois might be able to with farmland and extraction. So, yeah, I think that idea is kind of permeated in me and been instilled in me over the last 3 or 4 years, maybe 5 years, to the point where, you know, I went from a 25-year-old person who loved to hunt and enjoyed, as you said, the same kind of banquet idea that my tag money went back to conservation to a person who's now early 30s who feels like there's a mission at hand. And if we don't all serve that mission, then 10, 20 years from now, we'll be sitting around wishing we did.
Right.
So you feel like there's a generation gap there? My dad definitely always says to me, he says he's proud of our generation for stepping up as we have because there's a need to step up. And I don't know that the previous generation felt that need, and maybe there wasn't as pressing an environment.
Yeah, I don't think it was as pressing for, you know, like our father's generation, simply because the generation before them had put into, you know, the Pittman-Robertson Act, and then I never remember what it's called on the fishing side.
Dingell-Johnson.
But a similar, what is it?
Dingell-Johnson, which makes me giggle.
Dingell-Johnson.
Because I'm a child.
Which is a fairly unfortunate name. But,
yes.
no, I mean, the previous generation had enacted both of those bills where, you know, it was a huge stepping stone to, you know, to bring back the funding to conservation. And I think because, like, our father's generation was so huge, you know, in hunting and fishing, I mean, there were so many of them doing it that I think, like, their contribution simply from hunting licenses, fishing licenses, conservation banquets, that type of thing is way bigger than anything that our generation is doing now, because there are, you know, there's the baby boomer generation is 10 years from being done hunting, and the, you know, that's 30% of the current license holders, and there's nobody that's coming up to fill that gap. So I think it's our generation needs to do more. Buying a hunting license is not enough. I mean, it's great. Don't get me wrong. Like, I think anybody who has a hunter safety card, even if you're not going to hunt, should go out and buy a hunting license every year, because it's a contribution to conservation and managing herds and managing land and that type of thing. But no, I think our generation definitely sees the need to take action and not just go hunt, because it's not enough.
Yeah, I mean, it's hunting really peaked in the early 80s. And you looked at, like, when it really started to rise, it was post-World War I, post-World War II, and when a lot of people were coming back from the war and they had idle time. And technologies were starting to advance that allowed them to get further out into the wilderness and allow them to, you know, even in the turn of the century, you talk about refrigeration and railways and just easier ways for people to get out and experience hunting and then come back and enjoy the meat and just enjoy the experience. And that, I mean, I think that is where modern sport hunting came to be, because, you know, people have hunted on this continent for many hundreds of years. As long as we've been on it, there's been hunting. But modern sport hunting, right, came to its peak in the early 80s as a part of our dad's generation, right? I mean, that there was, you know, 1982, something like 17 or 18 million people purchased license, or were 17 or 18 million hunters or something like that. And that's kind of the peak. And I think that was the peak of our, you know, around the time we would have been born, but also around the time when our fathers were in their prime. So, yeah, shit, man, they were part of the prime in the history of modern sport hunting in the whatever, you know, 80, 90 years that it's been around.
Yeah. And, you know, what's interesting about that to me, though, is it was the prime for number of hunters, but it was nowhere close to the prime as far as number of species go, because, like, population numbers.
Yeah.
I mean, I grew up waterfowl hunting, and, like, the waterfowl numbers are the best they've ever been. And there's, you know, like, there's less than half of the number of hunters that there were in, like, the late 1970s. And there's, like, triple the birds or whatever the number is.
Yeah.
So it's kind of crazy math. It's been a strange shift, you know, away from, you know, people going away from hunting. And I think it's, hunting isn't easy. It's not in an age where instant gratification is, you know, something that a lot of people seek. Hunting is not that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I always describe it very much as like the idea of I'd like to go hunting, and actually going hunting and being proficient is like walking a tightrope across the Grand Canyon. I mean, there's no way to separate the idea from the reality and how far it is from just somebody who may listen to this or who may just think independently from this, I'd love to go hunting. And then trying to find that access, that skill, the to process all the ideas that go with killing another living thing and then going back and doing it again and again and again. I mean, all those things are tough to do. And I think our generation, unfortunately or fortunately, whatever, gets to do them in the public eye because we choose to through social media.
Right.
And through media. And you and I are in a business where we both profit off of hunting in a lot of different ways. And that's just changed things.
Yeah. You know, and kind of touching, like adding to that, I think one thing we've done bad as an industry as a whole, we need a PR agent, the industry does. But the one thing we've done a bad job of is we put so much emphasis on, you know, whitetail deer hunting and elk hunting and mule deer hunting and chasing all of these incredibly hard to hunt big game species. Whereas like our fathers would have, they deer hunt, but they also rabbit hunt and they pheasant hunt and they duck hunt and they squirrel hunt and they, you know, they do a lot of other types of hunting and small game hunting where people now say they're thinking about getting into the sport. And the person that they look up to, say, is Joe Rogan, right? Mm-hmm. And like Joe Rogan got them into hunting and then they go out and buy all the gear and then they go out in the mountains and they get their asses absolutely kicked and then they never go out again.
Yeah.
Instead of starting with pheasant hunting or duck hunting or whatever, and you start with small game and you go out and you simply enjoy the experience and you might shoot a bird or two or a rabbit or two.
Yeah.
And it's all about everything else, you know, instead of focusing on a big game animal. I think that's made it really hard for people to get into it.
Yeah,
because
glorifying the ultimate achievement, right? I mean, killing a bull elk with a bow, it should be the ultimate thing. I mean, that should be something you work towards for your entire life, not something you walk on the mountain and do in a weekend.
No. Yeah. And if you've never hunted before and you go out and you buy a bow and all the clothing, whatever, and you drive out to Montana and you walk into the mountains, like, it's going to be mentally challenging. And then when you don't shoot something, you're like, I just spent almost $1,000 on a tag. I spent $2,500 on clothing and a bow and all the stuff and fuel out here and all that. You know, I dropped $10,000 to get into this and then I didn't succeed if success is killing an animal for that, you know, person's mentality. But
oh, it almost has to be, especially if you start pushing like we've done in the past, like meat is the goal. Then, well, of course, killing something is the goal because that's the only way that happens.
Right.
Like, there is no other way.
Right.
I met a guy, couple of days ago here in Austin. And if you don't mind, I'm going to read, I'm pulling it up now as we were talking about this. This guy sent an email in to me through thehuntingcollective.com. I had listened to the podcast a few times, sent an email in, and then I actually got to meet him a couple of days ago. But this guy's name was Daniel Porter. And he wrote and he said, Ben, I'm not a hunter yet. I grew up in a fairly liberal household in Washington, D.C. Not only was I not connected with the hunting industry in any way, but in the middle of a concrete jungle, there's very little opportunity to do so in any way. And I also did not want to express my interest out of fear that I would be judged by my interest in guns. A year ago, I started listening to Joe Rogan. Through that podcast, I became familiar with John Dudley, Cam Haines, Remy Warren, Steve Ranella, and a host of other individuals and companies that promote hunting. And then I heard you on the Gritty Bowman podcast and it opened my eyes. Here was a guy with a simple yet complex philosophy that I had been waiting for. The thought of killing an animal still bothers me, and I'm a 44-year-old man. However, the idea that I could love animals, still take one's life, never occurred to me until I listened to what you and others had to say. It is a dichotomy that is truly, truly confusing, and yet one that I am desperately wishing to be immersed in. I have a 12-year-old son, and I very much want him to be involved in hunting and to be aware of the history and how we got here in the first place as a species. We're going to go javelina hunting later this year so that we can both experience this together for the first time. And he goes on to say a bunch of other stuff. And I got to meet that guy, Daniel Porter, the other day, and we sat and talked for a long time. And he had, even what you were just saying, Sam, Like, isn't that guy the archetype of what we were just talking about? I mean, listens to Joe Rogan, picks it up, wants to do it, and now has this great challenge of how the hell do I pull this off?
Right.
So we talked about his biggest problem in Texas, living in Austin, Texas, was access. So him and I talked through that for about an hour, and I kind of gave him a bunch of ideas what access could be, and then have emailed with him and give him some ideas about where he might be able to go, but he's trying to walk across that tightrope that is the Grand Canyon to get to the other side, which I find super interesting. I hope to follow Daniel and see how he gets it done, because it's not easy.
Yeah, and that's like a mini documentary in itself, is following someone, you know, of that age who has never done it before, and and follow their journey like into the sport. I think that would be super interesting to a lot of people who, you know, may be on the fence about how they feel about hunting in general.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, we know now, as we start to do studies and look around, as with that the baby boomer population that you mentioned, we know now that retention among young hunters who are introduced at an early age is much less effective than it is if somebody starts in their 30s now, because they start just like you and I did, with very little understanding of like the overall impact culturally and in our society. Then they turn 18 and they get a girlfriend and they go to college and they forget about hunting, and a lot of them never go back to it. But if somebody starts in their 30s, when they have a child who they want to show, and they learn about it, it sticks. Because they're able to have the finances and the mental capacity to handle the damn thing and do it.
Yep. Yep. So then the real trick is, how do we reach those people, and how do we, you know, cultivate that and get more of those people involved?
Yeah. I don't know.
That's, if anybody has the answer to that question,
I have no idea.
That's the ticket.
But I think, right, isn't there, yeah, like, so if you look at that 30%, because I'm glad you brought that up. There's a great article, I'm trying to find it now, it's called, there it is, Why We Suck at Recruiting New Hunters, Why It Matters, and How It Can Fix It. It was written by Natalie Krebs in Outdoor Life recently, here in January. And she talks about a lot of stuff in this, but most importantly is, if you take that 30% that's 55 and older, that's a baby boomer, and you eliminate them from the situation, we're kind of screwed. In fact, we're not kind of screwed, we're screwed. I mean, we're out of, we went from 17 million hunters in 1982 to possibly in, 2030, 6 million or less.
Right.
Yeah. But I think.
Yeah, and once they're done, I don't think, continue and then I'll go. Yeah.
Well, I like the phone podcast. You get to do this, like, you go, now I'll go. What I would say to that is, it's just like, if somebody like Daniel, so Daniel's 44. And he listened to Joe and then found this podcast and other voices of people that have helped him. But if he teaches his son, who's 12, the new way, right, which isn't how we were taught, but is very, I think, very just understanding of the complexity of hunting and how it plays out in our society and urbanization and kind of the conversation that needs to happen for everyone to understand hunting. If that guy teaches his 12-year-old son, and you can get 100,000 or 1 million Daniels to teach their son, well, then you have not only a new crop of hunters that are sub 55 years of age, but then even a newer crop of hunters that are, you know, youth hunters that are learning a new way. I think that's probably important overall.
Yeah, Adam, I feel like that's probably the avenue we need to go down.
Yeah.
To, you know, quote unquote, save the hunting industry. Because, I mean, once we lose those 30%, hunting's not over, hunting's not gone. But our voice, you know, in any sort of policy making is that's tough.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you and I are both early 30s. So we're kind of in that gap generation that's kind of wondering what happened before us and what will happen in the future. I mean, there just isn't, there's no answer to why either one happened the way it did.
Yep. And so this is a kind of a different thought, but, and you can correct me if you think I'm wrong, but I feel like there's less hunters now, for sure. I mean, that's in the math. But the hunters that are out there, I think through social media and through, you know, watching people who hunt hard, I think that the people that are out there in the field are, even though there's less hunters, if you go hunt public land, it feels like there's more hunter presence now more than ever, because the mentality is like, oh, I got to walk 5 miles in.
Yeah.
Whereas it used to be like, I'm going to go hunt, but you know, mile two off the road, like that's good enough. And I think, you know, I've seen it in a lot of places where I've been, where even there's not that many people hunting, but you end up bumping into people because they have the same mentality as I do, where I'm just going to walk until I'm pretty sure I'm not going to see anybody. And then, you know, we're all sitting there on the same knob.
So, yeah. Oh, we're 5 miles in. I used to do it. I did that as a kid. I'd try to walk. The further I walked them, I'd run into like the highway. And then there would be 18 people. And,
yeah.
And once I hadn't seen anybody for the 5 miles I'd walked in.
Yeah.
But yeah,
I think we need to recruit a new generation of road hunters.
Yeah, new generation of hunters that like to spook stuff into the core of the wilderness where we.
That's right.
Or we're waiting.
That's right. Yeah, guys that like to buy the license but don't like to do all the work.
They don't care about that Pittman Robertson tax. They'll buy 7 guns. That's fine.
That's right. Yeah.
Fun this bitch. I wonder how that'll all break down. I mean, it's going to take some decades for this all to shake loose, and it's hard to talk about it with just a bunch of numbers. Natalie did a good job in that Outdoor Life article of trying to break it down, but it's going to have to shake out. I mean, there was nobody in 1982, you know, prognosticating what it would be in 2018. There just is no way. There's no way to know. And I guess my overall, where I always stop when this line of conversation goes on, is that I think urbanization is going to be hunting's biggest tool in the future, just because people are going to be living in these cities and they're going to have this need to go outside and do something to connect them to nature. And then hunting's going to be there waiting for them. And they're like, oh, this, they do it one time. And they're like, holy shit, this is awesome. Next thing you know.
Yeah. I would agree with that.
Well, we shall see. We shall see. Yep. What's next for the bus, man?
So the bus, I think it'll be a big year for 2018 for the bus. Like I said before, kicking it off with some turkey hunting and stuff, rolling it out, driving out to Boise for the BHA rendezvous, and it's going to be parked at, if anybody else is going out there that's listening to this, the bus is going to be parked all weekend at White Dog Brewing, which is only about a block and a half away from the Boise Center, and going to try to plan some event for Saturday. With the bus and kind of be out there and giving tours and whatever. But, so going to the rendezvous, and then, I'm going to focus down. My original plan was to just live in the bus for a year. And, I did that all last fall. It turns out I can't get anything done. Like I shoot a lot of photos and video, and I have all this great content, and, but I don't have any time to sit down and get it all, you know, get it out to everybody who wants to see it. So I'm going to focus down a little bit this year and doing one or two big trips a month. Spring turkey, going to do some stuff in the Black Hills National Forest in South Dakota, a bunch of other public land turkey hunting here and there. But going into the summer in June, I'm doing a trip up to the Boundary Waters in northern Minnesota. I'm going to be talking a lot about the potential mine site up there and kind of what that means and that whole wilderness area. And then July, trying to work out some sort of a, you know, backpacking trip or something out on the national forest and out west somewhere. And but basically going to focus down one or two big trips a month and really, you know, kick out a lot of content for people and talk more about public lands and how they, you know, relate to private land and how we need both. And I'm going to be doing a lot of travel and a lot of photo and video stuff, and obviously rolling into 2018 hunting season, it's going to be busy. So it'll be a good year.
I have no doubt about that. Are you realizing that I was just looking around on Instagram, and Instagram has made that Joe Rogan cover on your page sensitive content?
Yeah. I wasn't able to see that, but I've had several people comment that it was sensitive content. So,
oh, man.
I don't know. I mean, it must be somebody must flag the post. You know, so, like, I had one person put a pretty negative comment on there, and so I deleted the comment because nobody needs that. And I'm assuming that they flagged it, you know, for whatever.
Sensitive. It says, this photo contains sensitive content, which people may find offensive or disturbing. Just people in general, not certain types of people, but all.
Right. Yeah.
But all people.
Which is pretty funny because it's literally just meat.
It's a picture of meat, man.
It's a picture of meat.
He's not doing anything but holding a picture of meat.
No, it's not like, you know, it's not like Joe's holding it up like he's eating a giant turkey leg or something. Which
yeah.
would be
he's not even
hilarious.
Doing anything
but,
to it. It's not even connected
yeah,
to an animal.
There. Yeah.
Oh god, yeah. This could be we could go down a rabbit hole with this conversation. Holy shit, I can't believe that photo is now sensitive content on the internet.
I know.
That
I know.
Is, anybody listening to this, check my page because I guess you can't see if it's your own shit's sensitive content. But
yeah.
Suffice to say, I think you and I post a lot of sensitive content.
Yeah, a lot.
Well, that's good. I like to be in that bucket.
Which is fine. I think it made a lot more people look at it. Cause,
yeah.
You know,
ain't that the funny
thing? I
think
a lot of people want what they can't have. And they're yeah. like, well, I want to see what that is.
Isn't that the funny part about that? They think they're protecting people, but really that people are just drawn to whatever it is that they can't see.
Yeah. Yeah.
In this case, it's Joseph Rogan.
In this case, it's a Joe holding a moose leg.
Holding a goddamn moose leg. Damn.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, good. Yeah. Back to the bus. I think I just personally appreciate what you're doing, and I think it's important, and any effort to shine a light on, you know, BHA or TRCP or just any piece of knowledge that folks can gain about these subjects is important. I mean, I will, you know, in all honesty, I'm a board member for BHA, but I think that just makes me more, my sense is a little more heightened when it comes to the public land discussion. But I think it's important for people to, and you've done a great job, especially with stuff in South Dakota you've been doing recently, and then Boundary Waters, of just pushing people to get educated. You know, you can talk
yeah.
all day about how important it is and get all real fluffy about America and America's ideals and what public lands mean. That's great. Anybody can fucking do that. Anybody can say that. But what any.
Yep.
But people can't say is, let's educate you on the Land and Water Conservation Act, or let's educate you on the mine they're proposing for the Boundary Waters and what that really is and what that could mean for the future. I think those things are important.
Yeah.
So I'm glad you're bussing it, making it happen.
Yeah. You know, and you know, everything's evolved, right, with ideas and whatever. And my original idea with the bus was to travel all over the country and, you know, go to different chunks. And then I realized that I don't have to travel that far to tell the same story because it's, you know, like I just want people to be able to relate to me and like what I'm doing and what I'm talking about with wherever they live. I mean, I don't have to go to, you know, whatever. I don't have to go to Utah to talk about, you know, how important public land is. I can, you know, I can go hunt my old haunts or go explore some new places and do the, you know, tell the same message. The one hunt that I'm pretty excited about this fall, I just found out that I drew my North Dakota any deer archery tag, which is fairly tough to draw, and so I'm going to go chase mule deer with a buddy of mine who lives in North Dakota. But I'm pretty pumped up about that because that entire, like a lot of the western edge of North Dakota is national grassland, but it's also home to the Bakken oil field, and it has been like the extraction. And the roads and the wells and all of that stuff that's been built on there, I'm excited to show what, you know, a national, like a federally owned place that has been turned into oil extraction is going to look like or can
yeah.
look like.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the places in the country that molded Teddy Roosevelt's, like, view of land was the Badlands in North Dakota. And so, you know, I want to show a bunch of, you know, video footage and photography of that area this year. And, you know, you can, like, if you remove all those roads and all those wells, you can kind of get an idea of what it would have looked like with none of that infrastructure in there. So
yeah.
that's, you know, I think doing projects like that means more than like just constantly cruising around in the bus going, hey, I'm in a bus, you know, like,
I'm in a bus.
I want to do things that are a little bit more meaningful.
Well, good. Yeah, I think those things are all important. And it's that, you know, I've found recently, especially when like the Land and Water Conservation Act is up for funding or up for defunding, moreover. And people have started to talk about it. Well, I can guarantee you there's a whole generation of people that have no idea what that is. And so you start to get this general idea about what that fund is and where it comes from, but you don't really see it in action. Right? You never, nobody ever delivers you a tangible example of what that money from that fund goes towards or where it comes from or, you know, the whole process. Same with Pittman Robertson. The same with your tags and license fees. There's no, you don't buy the license and then in the book it doesn't tell you where the money goes. At least as far as I know, I've never seen that.
No,
you don't buy the rifle and it doesn't tell you where that tax went. So I hope, you know, things like what you're doing are just specific examples that people can use to give a tangible meaning to these ideas that we're throwing around all the time.
Yep.
So, bravo. And then you also have Public Land Tees going, right?
Yeah. So started a t-shirt company to kind of in conjunction with the bus project, but publiclandtees.com, and $5 from every shirt goes to Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. And the reason, you know, a lot of people wonder why I chose BHA, and the reason I chose BHA was because right now they have what I feel is the largest voice talking to both people that hunt and people that fish, and to be able to cross that line is a big deal for me, and to be able to, you know, raise money for an organization that has a huge voice on in both of those communities is a big deal. So, but yeah, publiclandtees.com. And I do have some new designs coming out soon. I just need to get them mocked up on the digital side and then get them on the website for a pre-sale.
Good. I'm sure they'll be sensitive content. I'm sure they'll be
probably
very sensitive. Probably. Designs.
Yeah.
Well, good, man. Well, I just wanted to have you on and talk. I know we talk all the time. We'll be hunting a bunch this year, probably together, I'm sure. We can't seem to not do that, which I enjoy.
What we really need to figure out is how to get you on the bus at some point this year.
Well, that shouldn't be hard.
No, it won't be.
Well, I'll probably say, let's just say this. If you have an event at the Rendezvous, I'll be on the bus.
Okay,
I'll probably be the drunk guy in the back sleeping on the queen bed.
I'll be sure to lock up all of my valuables then.
Yeah, please. But yeah, I mean, I just think that as somebody who's, you know, relatively to most people a young man, and you same for yourself, like we've got a lot of years in this thing together, and it's good to know there's guys like you out there that care about the right stuff and are doing the right stuff. And I'll close by saying thanks, buddy. Really appreciate all you're doing.
Hey, yeah, thanks for having me on.
Beautiful. Talk soon, man.
Yeah, for sure.
That's it. Episode number 8 in the books. Appreciate Sam joining me, talking about all things public lands, all things hunting. Sam and I have a lot of stories to tell when it comes to big adventures. We've done a lot of them, and I appreciate always having Sam along. And I always compare that guy to, he's my Yanni. If I was Steve Brunell, he'd be my Giannis Patelis. And all compliments to everybody involved in that analogy. I really enjoy Sam. He's a great dude. So hopefully that conversation was enlightening for you guys. Thanks for checking us out. Go to thehuntingcollective.com for more of this type of conversation. You can hear from Steve Rinella. You can hear from Ryan Callahan, John Dudley, Charles Post. You can hear from Shane Mahoney, Aubrey Marcus, anybody that we've had in the first 7 episodes prior to this one is there at thehuntingcollective.com. They're also on iTunes and Stitcher. You can also read articles and watch videos, things that I've been involved in, not only on the website, but also at BennyOB301 on Instagram. Until the next time, folks, I really appreciate you all. Thanks for writing in. Thanks for commenting. Please go subscribe on iTunes. Please follow us. Please tell your friends to do the same. And we'll keep cranking out content for you. Thank you. See ya.
Hey, everybody knows Weber Grills. I've been using Weber Grills my whole life, and check it out. They got a pellet grill, the Weber Searwood Pellet Grill. Now, with a pellet grill, you can smoke, roast, and sear on the same grill. You can go from low and slow, okay, on smoke boost mode, or crank this thing all the way to a heat sear at 600 degrees. It's got a full great sear zone, so you can put more food on the flame. Get fired up for your new Weber Searwood Pellet Grill. Hey, we're going to take a little break here and talk about Interstate batteries. Now, if you're like me, enjoying the great outdoors, you need gear that is as reliable as it gets. That's why I power my adventures with Interstate batteries. I use Interstate batteries in my boats. I use Interstate batteries in my camper. Great for your truck, too. From Alaska to Montana, they're outrageously dependable. Battery is essential. With over 150,000 dealer locations, finding one is easy. For all your vehicles, land or sea, choose Interstate. Head to interstatebatteries.com and find your power today.